And now, it's my great pleasure to introduce our main speaker for the evening, and his name is John H. from San Diego.
I guess it's my 15 minutes of fame, folks. I'm John, I'm a nervous alcoholic. I didn't draw a sober breath from the time I was 16 till I was 45. And the reason I didn't draw a sober breath from the time I was 16 till I was 45, folks, is I drank essentially because I had secrets. And I'm going to... See, when I landed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to listen. I had to... See, I had diarrhea of the mouth. I thought I was so selfish and self-centered and egotistical. I didn't understand. I had some notorious bad behavior. And I had a lot of antisocial behavior because I couldn't function in society. But you see, what I have to do is go back to the causes and the conditions of my drinking. I was born in a small village on the banks of the Shannon in 1944 to a 19-year-old Irish girl who was my mother. That was fine. For the first 4 years and 3 months I was on the face of this earth, I had no problems. I had a grandmother who loved me dearly because my sponsor told me that somebody loved me. But on the 21st of June 1948, my whole world fell apart. It is as clear tonight as it was in 1948. I was 4 years old in 3 months, and I will never forget that car. I'd never seen a car because when I grew up in Ireland, there was no cars. And policeman, there's a big, huge policeman. And my mother gave me a small little multicolored ball and a hurley. And a hurley is what we play our national sports. I was born in a place called Killaloe, County Clare. So that cop and my mother took me on a car ride right down to Killarney. And it seemed like it went from 11 o'clock in the morning till about 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon. And I landed at this orphanage in Killarney, County Kerry. See, I'd already been through the court system. My grandmother died, so my mother's 19 and had no means of taking care of me. My mother had 5 sisters, and they all had, one of them had 17 kids, I think one had 15 kids. You know, they were DCs, and you know, the Catholic Church and devoted Catholics, that's what DC stands for, if anybody in here doesn't understand what it means. I learned that from my best friend, Doug B., up front here. But you see, that was the beginning of a life that I didn't understand. Because when I landed in that schoolyard, and there was big green gates, like dark green, and barbed wire on big, huge walls, they seemed like they went up into the sky. And next thing, my mother vanished. Oh, my good God, I let a scream out of me. I'll tell you something, I have never forgotten it. But I want to tell you one thing, folks. There's a lot of women here tonight. The nuns did not lay one hand on me. Not one hand. So I spent the next 6 years, from 1948 to 1954, in Killarney. And the nuns were taking care. We had to go to school, I guess, you know. I can't remember anything about it. The only thing I remember is the day going in and the day I was leaving. So in 1954, the next thing, another car lands back at the orphanage, and a guy in black clothes that looked like a priest with a collar on come out, and lo and behold, he says, "You're coming with me." You see, because I, now I'm riddled with fear. I mean, what am I going to do? He said, "John, you're coming with me." I said, "I am." So he takes me in the car right from Killarney, right through Tralee. There's another big, huge orphanage in Tralee with Christian Brothers in it. So, but I wasn't going into Tralee. I'm going up to Glen. I get up to this place in Glen. It has these huge high walls again, glass on them. But this is a living hell, folks. I don't know how many people in there have kids screaming. There's about 300 kids in there. And they pulled into this place and I got out. And next thing, Jesus Christ, this young kid's getting flogged. I thought, oh my good God Almighty, what is this all about? See, and I'm riddled with fear now. I don't know what's going on. And I'm starting to begin to hate these people. So for the next 5 years, I was locked up there in a place called Glen. I want to tell you something. I hated these people with a passion. And I want to tell you one quick joke before I go any farther. There's one Scotchman in here in this room, and he's right over there. And I want to ask you, why did Scotch invent whiskey? So the Irish wouldn't rule the world. That's what they thought. God, I thought I'd get it in. I'm a bit of a comedian, but that's all my insecurity, folks. Doug B told me that. He said, I'm addicted to excitement and attention. And I am. And I'm glad to be here tonight because I live in reality today. But I want to tell you, folks, at 16, I got out of those holiday camps. No, they weren't holiday camps, folks. They were concentration camps. But I want to tell you one story. What happened to me inside in that orphanage was to change my mind forever, or my life. They were beating us black and blue, you know, across our wrists were always swollen. But the flogging was a whole different ball of wax. If you ran away from there, you were automatically flogged. So one day they said to me, somebody said that I was playing with myself below in the long grass in the football field. So that's an automatic flogging. And you know, folks, I would claim an expert at blocking pain out. But you know the flogging? And it wasn't the flogging that I got. See, because they won't flog you right away. We're going to flog you next week. See, and it's that psychological torture. For a whole week. But you know what? I survived it. And see, what I have to do today, folks, is pray for those people. And the last thing I was doing when I came in, he was starting to pray for anybody. Because I was sick and I didn't understand it. So anyway, I went out into in the 30th of June 1960, a farmer came into the orphanage. J.H., you're going with me. So I went out onto this farm and I worked on it, and the first £1.50 I got. I want to tell you something. I didn't fly down to Rackheel to buy ice cream. I fly down to Rackheel to get the strongest fags they had in the shops over there. See, because I needed that addiction and I needed something to drown out the pain that I had. See, because I had a lot of pain and I didn't understand why I had this pain. You know what? I got those fags and I smoked them one after another for the next 20 years. And there was no tips on them because I caps them full strength. But then my mother sent for me. I have to go to England. And I want to tell you the story, folks, how my mother got to England. There's a thing in Ireland called the BSA. It's a motorbikes. They make motorbikes. Well, it actually stands for the Birmingham Short Arms. They used to make rifles in there. So then they started making motorbikes. So how my mother got from Ireland to England in 1949 was the BSA paid her fare over to Britain. And the BSA was located in Small Heath in Birmingham. So my mother went into the factory spraying gas tanks for the BSA. And next thing, in August of 1960, it's actually 47 years ago, that I got on a boat from Ireland. I had to get in a train from Limerick to Holyhead, and then I had to sail over to Britain. So I got to Britain in August of 1960, and my mom was living in Birmingham. By this time, she had met a guy that was cleaning windows who was from the north of Ireland. He was a window cleaner. They had a bike, and I guess my mom was in lodgings. So by the time I got to Birmingham, she had already had three more sons. She had a baby, and a seven-year-old, and an eight-year-old. And I had my small case with my suit in it. I'll never forget the day I landed that case into this corporation house that my mother lived in Birmingham. And the first words out of my half-brother's mouth was, "He ain't our brother. His name is Hogan, our name is Faye." So once again, folks, I had to take off. Plus, my mom was starting to tell me I can't do this and I can't do that. All I wanted to do was become a teddy boy. And I don't know how many people in here knows what teddy boys are. Teddy boys is you get a leather jacket with red lining on it, you wear drainpipe boots and winkle pickers. See, because I've got, who am I? What am I doing here? And I had some notorious anger towards my mom. I actually kind of hated her, to be rigorously honest with you people. She's a complete stranger to me. I couldn't function. But the next thing, I found the pubs. God, the pubs over in Britain were beautiful. And all the lassies in there, you know what I mean? There was the saloon bars, the public bars. So next thing, I started to drink. But you see, my alcoholism was like a snowball. It was real small, folks. It didn't get real big. It took a long time for it to get real big. See, because I was a functioning alcoholic. But I never understood that phenomenon of craving. And I'm really grateful that there was people here that sponsored me. And I've had one sponsor from the day I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for the likes of John LaFontaine, Rich Paul, all these people. See, I got sober right down here in Mission Center Road. A small meeting, see. But I can't get to there yet because that's way down the road. And I've still got about 35 minutes to talk and I don't know what I'm going to talk about next. See, then after I left my mom, I stayed with my mom for about 3 weeks or 4 months, maybe a month. I thought, I got to get out of this situation. So I got lodgings in Birmingham. I started working on building sites up there because all the Irish all automatically went to work on building sites. But you know what, folks? I had all those secrets. I just need to get a drink. Excuse me 1 minute. I've got to come down off the stage. So where was I at? I was working, that's right. Hang on a minute, folks. So I got lodgings. You see, and if you were from Ireland, and especially if you were anywhere around Limerick, and you started asking me anything about my childhood, I ain't going to mention one word to you. Folks, I'm taking that to the grave. And I want to go back to that day in August of 1960 that I left Ireland. I swore to God that I am never ever coming back to this hellhole, a place called Ireland. See, everybody thinks Ireland's rolling hills and green and everybody's having fun. There's a society over there and there was thousands of these places and thousands of kids went through these places and I was one of them. And lo and behold, they wrote a book about it. And it took me 50 years to find a book and you'll never guess what, my picture's in the book, I can't believe it. You see, because I got sober, I could go back and deal with it. See, because I didn't want to deal with it. I had it blotted out till I was 52. I mean, from 16 to 52, that's an awful long time. And I hadn't the faintest idea the day my mother dropped me in Killarney. You see, everything is clear today. But I don't do any more drinking. See, because the drinking took me into hell, folks. God, it was something desperate. But it started real slow. And I've had all kinds of things go wrong since I put the bottle down and came out of hiding. But you know what? I didn't pick up no drink. Because my sponsor asked me some profound questions. He asked me, not was I done drinking for today, but was I done drinking for good? And was I willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? You see, folks, I'm willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. That's why I'm up here tonight. Because thank God there was people here that spoke when I got here. And I haven't been here that long, believe it or not. But I was willing to take that direction. I had to go back to Birmingham. I was in lodgings one day and this guy started asking me about my childhood on a Friday afternoon. I had a few drinks. The next morning I had my bag packed and I was gone to London. See, because I'm always running. See, because I ain't going to let you know where I come from. I ain't going to tell you I'm illegitimate. I ain't going to tell you I was locked up for 12 years and 3 months in Ireland in orphanages. See, they were my secrets, folks, and that's why I drank, to drown out the pain, because the pain was so bad I couldn't handle it. Right, 1961, I landed down in Shepherd's Bush in London. Now I went into a hostel, and down in London it's a whole different scene with the pubs. They're drinking different kind of drinks down there, you know, and my drinking is starting to get like a little bit more. I was still functioning, I was still able to get up in the morning, I was still able to try to work. But what happened was I ran into this one lad. I was in the small crown in Windsor. I was about 17, maybe 18. 1960-61, the boys from Liverpool were coming out, Mick Jagger and the boys were just coming on the scene, and I loved rock and roll. All I wanted to be was like Rod Stewart, Mick Jagger. I just wanted to be anybody but me. See, because I hated me. I always wanted to be somebody else. See, today I am me. But I had to work at being me. Anyway, I run into this fella in the Green Man. And lo and behold, he has the same kind of secrets as me. But he was never in any orphanages in Ireland. He grew up in England. But his mother came over from Ireland and had him in England. But you know what? I knew that guy for 17 years. And he didn't know one thing about my childhood. But we drank for 17 years together. And you know what, folks? He never made it to 40. He put a rope around his neck and hung himself in 19... I got to America in 77. In 1978, he hung himself. But you know what? I was 24. They took me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Seeing he was older than me, if he was alive now, he'd be 70. And he drank a lot quicker and a lot faster than me. And he was in the British Navy. And he'd come knocking on my door. John's time for the pub, 7:30 at night. Jeez, if I go to the pub at 7:30 at night, by 9 o'clock I'm throwing up in the toilets. Because I'm not a kind of a big fella, I'm small, you know. Those pints are rather big. And then he says, John, you have to start drinking rum and black currant. Oh, Jesus Christ, that rum and black currant was fucking horrible. Excuse my language, folks, I don't need to be swearing. And I'd drink and I'd go home. You know, I was only 17, 18. And I'd go home and the room would be spinning and I'd be throwing up. And I think, God. But I thought that was natural behavior. I thought it was natural to carry on like that. It's not, folks. It's unnatural. It is. Trust me, I've been there and I know it. Well, anyway, let me get back to Anthony Fanning. He was my very best friend. And we used to go to the pub every Friday, every Saturday, anytime we had money. But he wanted to go every night. And he never wanted to go home. You know, he was kind of on the wild side, and he was a bit older, and he'd already been married and divorced. I wasn't even married yet. So one day he got married, and he asked me to be his best man at his wedding. I was his best man at his wedding. And he tried to commit suicide when I lived in England, and I didn't understand it back then. See, he was slowly going insane from the drinking. And he had another addiction called gambling. And if you notice, Andy, I know when people here have been to Britain, every pub has a bookie office right next to it. Because the gambling and the drinking go hand in hand, like the cigarettes and the drinking. See, I was into the cigarettes and the drinking, but he was into the cigarettes, the gambling and the drinking. I ain't giving the money to the bookies, I don't mind getting drunk on it. But I ain't giving it to them, I'm too tight. And it says in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're as tight as the barks of trees, and they're dead right. Don't be told me that. And Mike. Hey folks, my sponsor's here tonight. And I'm sure glad he's here. Because that man saved my life. And that man got all those secrets out of me. You see, because I was going to take him to hell. But let me get back to Anthony Fanning. I was about 24. And Tony was on an awful day. He said, John, I've got to go and get help. He said, we've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. And the Alcoholics Anonymous was in a church right next to the Green Man in Wembley. Well, I want to tell you something. I went in there. Now, I don't trust nobody. Nobody. And the first thing I heard when I went into that meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in Wembley, we were talking about two things. They were talking about their secrets. I see Larry Dixon is here tonight. God, am I sure glad, Larry, you're here. See, because I've learned to have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. Folks in Ireland, I didn't have a friend in the world. There's a lot of people in here that I know, and I'm glad to know them. See, because it's all about giving. It's not about taking. See, I was a taker. See, I didn't know how to give. I was incapable of giving anything because I was so selfish and self-centered. And I'm an alcoholic, and I got this huge ego, and I'm always looking for a free lunch. And folks, there is no free lunch. Everything has a price to it. Am I willing to pay the price? See, I'm willing to pay the price. I am willing to get drunk today no matter what goes on. But I have to go back to Anthony Fanning. Well, I got into this meeting anyway. It wasn't quite as big as this, maybe like this crowd, maybe half of it. And they were talking about two things that I didn't want to hear nothing about. They were actually talking about God and their secrets. Man, I tell you one, I done a beeline for that door, and I never ever came back again. Never. I thought, I ain't never going back there. I'm never getting them secrets out of me. And God, wasn't I locked up long enough? And they were telling me in Ireland that, I was going to be burning in hell forever. Forever. Burning. God, no wonder I need a drink at 16. But I didn't know how screwed up I was, folks. And I was, and I'd be the first to admit it. I was incapable of having a true relationship with any human being on the face of this earth. And how could I be a parent if I had no parents? My sponsor from some old timers taught me in this room of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't give away something I don't got. And you know what, folks? They're dead right. See, I learned from old timers. I had to learn how to live in the solution because I had no idea how to live in the solution. I was always in the problem. Well, I came to America on the 16th of March. Oh, I have to go back. I have to tell you how I got here. Well, then one day, I was about 23, 22. Now I'm working in London, Heathrow Airport, and I'm getting a tan, you know what I mean? I'm freaking Jack the Lad, and I'm drinking more now. It's getting really tasty, you know? And be down in the bars throwing darts and throwing tanners into the jukebox and thinking I'm Jack the Lad and I'm cool. And all I'm doing is getting drunk, folks. I thought I was going in there to get girls. But once I had a few years of sobriety, my girlfriend was the bottle. But unfortunately, I met a girl inside in a pub in the Stonebridge Park Hotel in Wembley. She had come from America. She had gone to school here. And lo and behold, you know what? The last thing I wanted to do was get married. But I got married. And we had two children. One was born in 1969. And one was born in 1971. See, my wife wanted always to get out of England because she grew up here as a child. My granddaughter had pictures of her going to school in Los Angeles that I had never seen till about a year ago. But when she said, John, we're going down to Australia. Oh, I said, all right, Sandra. Because in England at the time, if you were a tradesman, you could immigrate to Australia for £3.10. But you had to go over there, to go to work for a company for 2 years and they'd pay your fare out there. And I said to Sandra, yeah, no problem. I just want to keep the peace. I said, yeah, I'll go to Australia with you. But you know what? When it came to go down to sign the papers, I backed right out. And she, So then one day in 1975, she came up to me. She said, John, we're going to America. Jesus Christ, America? She pulled out an American passport. She said, John, I'm entitled to go to America. And she said, I'm going, and if you're not coming, I'm going on my own. Oh, Lord Almighty. See, I was still functioning. And we bought a house together. I had a real nice home in England, and I put an addition on the back. And I had a Sparks working for me. We call Sparks electricians. And he said, J.H., you'll be going to L.A. I said, what? What's L.A.? I didn't even know what L.A. stood for. It stands for Los Angeles. I had never been on a plane in my life, folks. Never. Next thing I'm on this big DC-10, New Zealand Airlines, and the first stop was L.A. I landed in L.A. on the 16th of March, 1977. One of my children was 4, and the other was 7. And Sandra was about, in her 30s. I was coming up on 33, so she was about 26, 27. And I want to tell you something. I landed in L.A., and I lived in Britain for 17 years, and I was not used to this. First of all, I was never used to the friendliness of America. Because I'll never forget when I got off the plane, Christina went up to this big, an African-American guy who's a CCUK guy. She said, so could you show me some American money? God, next thing he put his hand into his pocket and pulled out a 5 cents and a 10 cents. I'll never forget it. And he gave it to my daughter and he said, welcome to America. God, I thought, is that nice or what? Because back when in England, if you had an accent like mine, they wanted nothing to do with you. Nothing. Especially if you're Irish, man. They didn't go too well on us Irish in England, but I married an English, she was English. I got on real well with him. And then I got to America, and now I'm in America, and the drinking is really starting to get kind of even better, because they've other drinks that I'd never heard of. Jack Daniels, Southern Comfort. God, they sound really good. Southern Comfort, what more can I ask for? Makes you real comfortable. God, I just loved it with a passion. But I'm still smoking the fags, and lo and behold, then they have this other stuff here. This wacky tobacco, it looks like a bag of weed. And I went to live with this fella because I was fighting with the wife, you see. We were starting to kind of not get along, you know what I mean? And it was over here on Texas Street, 1977, 78. This fella had about 14 bags of this. It looked like weeds that you'd have in Ireland growing on. It had all stuffed in under his bed. And he said, "John, would you like some of this?" I thought, "What?" No, I said, "Jeff, I can." But I was smoking the fags. God, next thing he rolled up this joint of green stuff, and Lord Almighty, my whole world changed forever. God, the drink was nicer, the southern comfort was better, and I got a huge appetite for munching on biscuits and... Jesus. And I was driving on the freeway, and I had a few drinks and the freeway was going like that. I thought... God, it was great fun altogether. Everybody was partying in their backyards. See, in England, everybody got dressed up and went to the pub. And it's dark and it's raining, you know. But here in Southern California, everybody's out in the backyard. They got coolers. They're carrying coolers everywhere. God, I got me a big cooler and filled it up with Budweiser. The long necks, I loved it. I had it for breakfast, lunch and dinner. See, because my alcoholism was getting worse and worse, folks. That's what it is. And it wasn't funny. It sounds funny, but it wasn't. It was a living hell, believe it or not. I was married. And the height of my alcoholism come in 1982. When Sandra came home one day and she had a new man in my bed. But you see, folks, she had every right to have that man in my bed because I wasn't paying her the slightest bit of attention. But back then, I was always blaming her. It's her fault. She brought me over to America and took off with a sailor and left me with two kids. See, because I'm an expert at pointing the finger at everybody and never wanting to take a good look at myself. See, because I'm always looking for a free lunch and there is no free lunch. So I got divorced in 1982 after 16 years of marriage. But I want to tell you folks, I didn't know what I had till it was gone. And that's gospel truth. I didn't know what I had till it was gone. But I didn't understand how my alcoholism and her childhood, you see, we were made for one another because I thought I had a bad childhood. Her childhood was 10 times worse than mine. See, we were made for one another and we knew one another's secrets. I never told anybody else them. And she taught me hers, and I believed every word she told me. Now my children are starting to grow up. My young daughter was 12, and we were living in Lakeside. I had a beautiful home out there, 3-bedroom, 3-car garage. I put 20 grand down there that I brought from England in 1978. Had a beautiful home. By 1982, it was all gone. And my oldest daughter was hooked on crystal meth. You see, that's where my alcoholism took me. She tried to commit suicide. I went to Grossmont Hospital one Sunday. She's inside there, they have her pump in her stomach. She's 12. No, she wasn't. She was 16 when she tried to commit suicide. She had a baby at 14. She was hooked on crystal meth. So today I have a 23-year-old, she was 24 last Saturday, a 24-year-old grandchild with two great-grandchildren. But you see, it was getting to become a living hell, folks. It wasn't getting funnier. You know, I can crack and laugh about it and tell you, it's not funny no more. The fun is all over. I was getting sicker and sicker. And I couldn't deal with it. And I always wanted to have a girlfriend. But you see, I didn't know how to have a girlfriend because every time I go to the bar, I thought I was going to the pubs to look for girls. You know, here in America, especially with my accent, they thought I was from another out there. They asked me, was I from down under? I said, no, I'm from back yonder. They thought I was Australian. Telling them I'm an out-of-work movie star and a soccer player. I was a notorious liar because I couldn't tell the truth. And I'm always looking for attention. That's gospel because they kind of get off on us, you know. I'll never forget us coming over to that DC-10 from Los Angeles. And the Manhattan Transfer were a rock band and they were on there. God, and there was this gorgeous fox on there. She was the tour manager. And I don't know. I had pretty long hair back then, you know, the 70s, you know, you'd have sidelocks and a whisker that came down here. And I was kind of cracking with her all the way over. God, you know, now I look back and I don't know what Sandra was thinking, you know what I mean? But, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I'm not interested in nobody but myself and my behavior. So anyway, I'm still drinking away, carrying on. I got divorced in 1982. Now I thought she's gone. I went out to the Colorado River one night and nearly killed myself. I got drunk and I started drinking that Mad Dog 2020, and I was with this roommate of mine. And he said, John, he said, you're the luckiest man on the face of this earth. I said, why is that, Jeff? He was my roommate. He was the guy that had all them bags of weed under the bed. See, we became the best of friends here. And we'd go to the Colorado River, and he'd go down to the wet T-shirt where the women gets all the water thrown on them. They throw up their jumpers and stuff. I got drunk and blacked out, and I was in the campground. I could never make it down to them places because I was intoxicated. And I was blacking out. Well, one night he came home, and he had those, you know, he's a Yank, so he had those trucks with big wheels on them, you know, about this wide. And I came 2 in the morning. He said, John, you're the luckiest man alive. I said, why is that, Jeff? He said, I missed your head by about 6 inches. And he told me the security guard sent him down to the river to pull me out of the river. I was blacked out below in the Colorado River. That's how bad my drinking got. See, it was a living hell. And it was sad, and I was lonely. And it was horrible, and I was sick, and I didn't understand it. So then one day, I went down to Mission Valley. I thought, I'm going into one of these singles shows, you know what I mean? See if I can get me a nice girl. You know what I mean? I need somebody to be hugging on. God Almighty, it's cat being on your own. So I went to this single thing, and there's a fox in there. So I put the make on her, and she's lo and behold, she took it. You know? But anyways, didn't do any drinking because I wanted to get to know her. Lo and behold, it was my 45th birthday, I think. And I bought a 24-pack. And lo and behold, I drank 23 of them and went to see her. And she had already brought me another 12-packet that was in the house, and I drank that. Well, I was slaughtered, and she told me to get out of the house and never come back, that you're reminding my children of their father who died of alcoholism at 40. And this was right in Santee here, folks. 10 minutes from where I live. So then I got the moment of clarity. I thought, you're right. But I had been working for Irish contractors here, hanging wallpaper and stuff, and I could never show up for work. And this one Irish contractor looked me in the eye one day after I blacked out in his house on Sunday morning. He said, John, you're alcoholic. God, I got as mad as a match here. I thought, that wanker, who gives him the authority to call me an alcoholic? That shyster, I thought. Who does he think he is? And he's a Mayo man, and I hate Mayo men. And he had race horses, and you know, he's a big shot. But you know what, folks? He was telling me the truth, and I just didn't want to hear it. And that's gospel truth. But on the 8th of May, 1989, I picked up the phone. For the first time in my life, I was... The pain, see, it's all to do with the pain. And the pain got bad enough. So I thought, I got to do something. I will never forget, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I picked up the phone. And they told me there was a beginner's meeting below on Hillcrest, and was I willing to go down to it. I went to that meeting in Hillcrest. So now, see, I'm like a baby with a bottle. So you pull that bottle out of the baby's mouth, he starts screaming, you know what I mean? Because he used to tip him, you know what I mean? My chin was kind of tight to my chest. Fuck him, I ain't doing nothing. That's the way I was going around. What do you want? My head was, because I was so angry at all these issues that I never dealt with. Fuck him, that's what I was saying, fuck him. And looking for a free lunch again. And there is no free lunch. Well, anyway, on Tuesday morning, well, it was a Monday I called him. Then one day, there's a meeting right down the street here, Drunks Only. I walked right into Drunks Only, and on the third day I walked in there, my sponsor came up to me, who is my sponsor today, and has been my sponsor since the day I got here. He said, John, would you like to go and have a cup of coffee with me? Well, I want to tell you something, I trust nobody. But I went with him because I had something in common with him. For the first time in my whole life, I was 45 years of age, he slowly got those secrets out because he started asking me about my childhood. And I ain't going to tell him, I start crying because I just started to trust him. Lo and behold, he got all the secrets out of me. Now he says, John, I said, yes, Mike. He said, this was about the fourth day, and I was all messed up. I don't tell you something. I had to know what was going on. He said, I'm going to be taking you to a step study. I said, yeah, Mike. I said, where's this step study? He said, it's over in Spring Valley. But Mike, I live up in San Carlos. What in the name of Jesus do I want to go to the Dust Bowl for? He got right up on the top of my nose and said, and before he got up on the top of my nose, he said, and another thing, John, you'll be making coffee for 15 weeks. Lord Almighty, I am. But I said, Mike, I live up in St. Carlos, and this step study is below in Spring Valley. He got right up on my nose. He says, aren't you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? Mike, I'm willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. I'm still going to that step study today. And I made that coffee for 18 weeks, or whatever time I became the leader. So then my sponsor started asking me about how I was feeling. I lived in St. Carlos up here, and there was a lot of Jewish people in there, school teachers, and I used to have to sneak in and sneak out. Because my nose, when I drank whiskey, got huge and red, you know what I mean? And I needed to hide, and I was afraid of Jaime and B, Mary Cragen, Nancy Ryan. But you know what? Every one of them folks knew I was an alcoholic. I wasn't fooling them. I thought I could fool people. I could fool nobody. They had my inventory taken long ago. The day I moved in there, they had it taken. Because I'd be sneaking in the middle of the night. Then if I was really intoxicated, I wouldn't go home at all. I'd stay over at the Mule's house. This was another buddy of mine that I met in America. They would call me their oldest son. I was practically living with them, drinking and doing nothing but drinking all day and all night. But Mike Pritchard got a hold of me, and he started asking me about my childhood. And I want to tell you something. Thank God he did. Because he walked me right through those steps. He said, John, you go home and write an inventory. And write everything down about who you're mad at. But you know what, folks? I didn't have to tell him what was eating my lunch. He had already known. Because now he had known me for 6 months. And he'd been taking my inventory all these times. But you know what? I'd done everything the man told me to do. I wrote out that port. He told me to write. I still got it at home. All these years. And he told me one day to write about how you're feeling. God, I wrote this thing, fucking Jaime and B. God, and I'm all stone mad at all these people. And 10 years later, when I had no drink in me for 10 years, I looked and I had to laugh at it. God, I thought I was that angry. I was really angry, folks. But I had to take those steps. And I want to tell you here, because I don't know how much more time I got. Till the day I go into the grave. The most profound thing I've ever done in my life. You know that lady that bore me those two beautiful children? And that was my wife for 16 years. Instead, I had to go back and apologize to her. And I've done it up here in Fletcher Parkway in the Denny's. I want to tell you something. Till the day I go into the grave, folks, it's the most profound thing I've ever done in my life. You see, instead of hating her, I became to love her. She was the children, my mother's children. I didn't know it. I didn't know how much hatred I had in me. And you know what, folks? The American of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, John, it wasn't all your fault. Lo and behold, she got sick. She got cancer. So I could be at her deathbed when she died, and I said, Sandra, I'll do anything on the face of this earth to help you. See, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. See, today I fit into my own skin. I belong somewhere. Oh, and then my sponsor, I will never forget my license. I was a contractor. When I was drinking, I thought, you'll have to excuse me, swear, fuck him, I ain't paying that, you know. I had to get a bond or something for $7,000, and all I could see was, fuck him, I ain't giving it to them. I ain't paying that. So I let my license run out, and it ran out for 10 years. So my sponsor asked me, he said, John, what do you do, paying the contract? I said, yeah. He said, you better get up and get that license back in order. Jesus Christ, I got it in 1978. This is 1992, 93. I thought I'd go up and ace that in 2 minutes. Jesus, all the laws have changed. Now they've got two books with computers and all this and that. God, I came back to Mike Wine and I said, God, Mike, I can't do it. But Jesus Christ, he gave me a lift into the solar plexus that threw my head backwards. He said, get off your lazy ass and stop complaining and get back up there and take that test. See, I needed that. I needed that. But I want to tell you something. Mike Prison never told me to go down on my knees. And he taught me some profound things. He says, John, for the first 3 years you were in Alcoholics Anonymous, he never took his eye off me. Because every time I got nervous or I needed to take a drink, he was always there. The man saved my life, folks. That's all I can say. And I want to go back to my friend Tony Fanning. I did not set foot in Ireland for 36 years. And you know those holiday camps I was telling about, they were concentration camps? Well, that all came out in 1999. And I hadn't set foot in Ireland from 1960 to 1999. And you never guess what took me back to Ireland, folks. Right back to Killarney, where my mother dropped me in 1948. There was an AA convention in Killarney. And I had 6 years of sobriety by then. They had 50 years of AA in Ireland. And that guy, I was his best man at his wedding. I tried to find his wife. I've gone to Ireland 3 times to find her, to tell her my story. Because she knows nothing about my childhood. And he has kids my age now, they're all in their 40s, but I will find her. And the biggest gift of the lot, folks, was 12 months ago. I have a real good friend. He's not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's from the north of Ireland. And he was on his deathbed, you know, from leukemia. And he survived it. So he asked me last year, would I go to Ireland with him? I said, yes, certainly, because I can go anywhere now. Before, I was always fantasizing about going. I don't fantasize anymore because I got a few shillings in my pocket and I can go. My head's real clear. All my bills are paid on time. And you'll never guess what, folks. I went over to Ireland November of last year. And you'll never guess what I ran into. They're having a massive remembrance for all the lads that were in the orphanages all over Ireland. I had seen people I hadn't seen in 46 years. They're the Americans of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the Christian brothers was there. He said, what's your name? I said, my name is John Hogan. He said, I don't know if I know you. I said, I've never forgotten you. He might not remember me, but I'd never forgotten those boys. There was 22 of them in black with collars and beating us. I gave him a big hug. I said, it's all right. See, because I have to forgive those people. And my mom, after about 5 years in Britain, I went back to her. She said, John, I thought you were locked up. I said, Mom, do you think I was locked up long enough? But then I went back once I got sober in 1996 to the convention. I went by and seen her. And she had all her faculties together and I told her I loved her. And I have 3 half-brothers. And one of them needs in here, folks. But he ain't coming. But that's not my problem. I don't see anything to him. James is his name. Still loves to toss down the drink. Divorce. He's out of control. But I'm not in the people-fixing business. But it was ironic when I went home in 1996. I don't know how he figured out. He said, John, you're in it. In AA. I said, yeah, I'll go to AA. I said, I got to go there because it saved my life. Because deep down in my core, if I pick up a bottle, I'm going to die drunk and I'm going to die alone. And I have to go back to those 2 children of mine. Now they're grown. My oldest daughter's 39. And I talked to both my kids before I came here tonight. I love them dearly. I tried to be the father that I couldn't be when I was drinking. I've been to 18 Thanksgivings, 18 birthday parties, 18 Christmases. Because I've been doing this for 18 years and 4 months. And I want to tell you, folks, if I go out of this world tomorrow, it'll be the best 18 years I've had on the face of this earth. Because I've learned how to live in the solution and not the problem. Another thing my sponsor told me, he says, John, every time you go to do work for anybody, he says, you give them 125%. That's what I try to do today, folks. And you know that step study I used to go to? God, there was a fella in there. I don't know how many people even know him. His name's LaFontaine. He has a ponytail. And I used to go there, I was brand new, and John LaFontaine would come in with his big leather purse and his big book, and I had so much anger towards that because he would remind me of the Christian brothers. He'd smile, I'm alcoholic, my name's John L. God, I hated him. Oh, Lord. I wanted to go home and pull that ponytail, get a scissors and cut it off. Do you know what? John L. is a wise man. John L. has been on this earth a lot longer than I have. And I listen real carefully to what John L. says. See, because John L. is like me. John L. is an alcoholic. And I'll never forget the day he gave me a big, huge kiss up here, right up here in the back of the neck. I thought, what in the name is he doing? He says, John, you're on your way. He must have seen some change in me. You know what? From coming to hate the man, I come to love the man. He's a real good man. That's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. To love people. See, because I didn't know how to do it. There's a man right here in front of me, Doug B. Another man. Kept me fully employed in 1999. I was below outside the door feeling sorry for myself, waiting for the meeting to come up open. Lo and behold, he pulls right in next to me. God, I thought there's a big, huge contractor. And next thing, we went to the meeting, having the gimping, you know, carrying on. Lo and behold, after 1 or 2 days, he says, John, would you sponsor me? Jesus Christ, Doug, I said, I don't know if I'd be able to sponsor you. But I tell you what, I'll be your temporary sponsor. On the 20th of August this year, I'll have been temporary sponsoring him for 16 years. And we're the best of friends. See, and my sponsor taught me one profound thing. And it's nearly time for me to finish. He says, John, you'll never be able to love a woman till you love a man. And you know what, folks? It's nothing to do with sex. Nothing. There's a lot of men I love today, and I hug men. See, because I learned it in here. I learned how to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't the faintest idea how to carry on. And you know what, folks? I get back what I'm dishing out. I never did understand that. I'm dishing out, or I'm lying. I don't lie today. I have to tell the truth. Because what happens is the truth sets me free. And that daughter of mine that tried to commit suicide 2 years ago this month, she went back on that crystal meth. And she was up in Moreno Valley. She's in the mortgage business. They have a 6-bedroom house and 2 new kids and a small baby. And they found her out in this field burned. And people are telling me, John, you need to get up there and help her. I have to stay miles away from her. But I told Rosie on the phone, see, because she started to blame me for all her problems. I said, Rosie, if I have to go to your funeral, I ain't drinking. I can't fix him. I just got to hug him and love him. I love him dearly. I went to Las Vegas with her the other day, and I'd never been in Las Vegas. I never want to go there again. Trust me. It's too cold out there. I'm only joking, folks. They had to go out there for a convention. Her and her husband are in the mortgage business. So they needed me to babysit. See, that's how I make amends to those kids today. I mind their children. And I have 7 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren and 2 son-in-laws. And not one of them seen me take a drink. My oldest daughter married 3 alcoholics before she was 30. She's always trying to find somebody like her father. And that's gospel. But I can't fix her. But I love him dearly. Thank God I got him. Especially at this age of my life, you know what I mean? And my younger daughter, we call her the queen. God, she just loves to boss me around, folks. And I just love being bossed around by a queen. She tries to put me on guilt trips. She says, Dad, I liked you a lot better when you were drinking. I know, Christina, you loved me when I was drinking because you could get away with it, living in hell. Because I needed to run you here and run you there because I was always feeling guilty for leaving him and I needed to go away drinking. See, I don't drink today no matter what. And I have a lot of good friends in here. Rose D's back there, that I can have relationships with people, that I don't have to put any expectations on anything. And I have to learn how to grow up and live in the solution, not the problem. I am blessed to live in America. I am blessed to be here tonight. I have to write that gratitude list every day. And thank God for everything of what I got instead of about whining what I don't got. I am the luckiest man on this earth. Believe me. And I didn't understand. I want to tell you something before I finish. It's getting near 9 o'clock. If you told me the day I walked in here that I'd be like this today, I'd say, no. I live in a world I didn't know existed. See, because I belong. I belong somewhere. I belong in AA. And that's why I come to AA. Because I'm an alcoholic. And I have to take that direction. And that rigorous honesty, I want to tell you something, that's kind of tricky stuff. You know what I mean? My sponsor's always taking me into my inventory, and I just love it. He told me he was coming down here tonight to take my inventory. Well, I'll finish with that, folks, because I got an hour for him to take my inventory. And I do appreciate you all coming out to hear me tonight. I don't know what I had to say, or if you got anything out of it, but I'll tell you what, it does feel good to be up here now that it's over. Thanks.